Yesterday's surprise Supreme Court decision has people wondering how dramatically the new law will change the healthcare landscape in this country. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, we'll get a perspective on the changes in healthcare from Dr. Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College. A physician, Kington was principal deputy director at the National Institutes of Health before becoming Grinnell's president in 2010. We'll also find out about some new things going on at Grinnell College. Before that, a conversation with noted space historian Andrew Chaikin. He'll be visiting Iowa to talk about the search for life in the solar system. T-minus 5 minutes and counting before that conversation, right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest in the first half hour is Andrew Chaikin. Chaikin is author of the acclaimed A Man on the Moon and several other books about space. You also know him as a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. He's also appeared on Good Morning America, Fresh Air, Talk of the Nation, and The Colbert Report. Chaikin co-produced, along with Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, the HBO series From Earth to the Moon. And Andrew Chaikin is coming to Iowa. On Friday, July 6th, he'll be at the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines. Then on Saturday, July 7th, he will be featured as part of a day-long space event at the Englert Theater in Iowa City in what's being called a Spacetacular event presented by the Iowa Space Science Center. And he joins us by phone for this first half hour. Andrew Chaikin, what a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here. I have to demote myself, though, on one count. As much as I would love to have been a co-producer of the miniseries, actually, I wrote the book that I wrote inspired the miniseries and was the one of the main basis for it. But the production duties were handled all by Ron Howard and his gang.
Okay, thank you for that correction.
Sure.
Let's reach out to our listeners in this half hour. You can put your questions about space and space exploration to Andrew. Also, questions about the search for life in space. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or you can give us a tweet at IPR Talk. Andrew, in 2007, you brought out this magnificent three-volume work called A Man on the Moon. I have it with me in the studio here. What a nice work that is. You took a decade to make it based on hundreds of hours of in-depth interviews with each of the 24 moon voyagers, our astronauts, as well as those who contributed to their efforts, training, teamwork on Earth. And in that book, you wrote, "We touched the face of another world and became a people without limits." Now, I'm sure you're aware that during the race for the GOP presidential nomination, Newt Gingrich said by the end of his second term that we would have, under his administration, the first permanent base on the moon. Here are some of his comments.
At one point early in my career, I introduced the Northwest Ordinance for space. And I said, I think the number's 13,000. When we have 13,000 Americans living on the moon, they can petition to become a state. And here's the difference between romantics and so-called practical people. I wanted every young American to say to themselves, I could be one of those 13,000. I could be a pioneer.
Andrew Chaikin, Gingrich's comments were made fun of. What did you think of them?
Well, you know, Newt Gingrich is a space fan, and I think he always has been. So, you know, it's never a bad thing to hear somebody on the public stage talking about the need for space exploration. Obviously, I'm very passionate about that, and I think it's something that we as human beings must do to be fully human. Mm-hmm. Now, however, and this is a big however, I don't think it was realistic from either a technological or an economic point of view. We're still struggling to get back to where we were 40 years ago. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the last human footprints on the moon in December of 1972. And the reason that we haven't gone to the moon since then is because Apollo was really a proxy for a war. It really was a substitute for a shooting war with the Soviet Union. Thank God we didn't have one, but we went to the moon instead as a way of demonstrating our might, our technological prowess, our motivation, our determination. People have said that that's why when President Reagan promised to build an anti-missile defense system, that the Soviets took him seriously, and it helped hasten the demise of the Soviet Union. I don't know how to evaluate that since I'm not a political scientist, but I can tell you that space exploration is still something that matters to nations who want to be taken seriously. And the reason I say that is primarily because of the Chinese. If you look at what they're doing, they've just launched their third human space mission and brought it back just in the last couple of days, which included a docking with their own space station, and they are determined to put people on the moon. And I think that that's all happening because of the same kind of historical arc that we went through in the 60s, where in the 50s and 60s, I should say, where Sputnik really shocked the daylights out of us and woke us up to the fact that science education was in crisis here, that we needed to do something to show the world that we really were leaders in technology and in industry. And that's what gave rise to the space program as we experienced it in the 60s. Today, we have a crisis again in which science education is in trouble. Our students are not by any means the world leaders. We're pretty far down on the list compared to other nations in education in general and science education in particular. And I think that the fact that the NASA budget for exploration has been cut, especially the robotic missions to explore the solar system, something that's very close to my heart. You know, these are the things that really provide a magnet for young people to study science and math and engineering, and they showcase to the world the best in us. And I think we are living in a tough economic time, but it's not an either-or. You know, the NASA budget amounts to about half of one penny on the dollar. It's a tiny little slice of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons I think that Gingrich's proposal was not realistic. But the spirit of it, that we should really put exploration on a high priority, I completely agree with.
NASA is currently relying on Russian rockets and capsules to ferry American astronauts to and from the orbiting space station, but the agency is hoping to begin flights on homegrown commercial vehicles by 2017. How do you see private industry changing space exploration?
Well, now you're on to one of my absolute favorite topics, because I am more excited about what is happening with the private companies than I have been about anything in human spaceflight in a very long time. And in particular, I'm very excited about the company in Hawthorne, California called SpaceX, which just launched the first commercial cargo mission to the station. And the reason it's so exciting to me is that the people at SpaceX have done something that nobody's ever done before. They sat down with a blank sheet of paper and they said, how can we redesign, how can we create a new spaceship that is low cost as well as being reasonably safe and reliable? And it turns out that the common element of all those things is if you can simplify the design. And that's very hard to do, but they've been working for over a decade on that, and they're making tremendous progress. And the booster rocket that they use and the spacecraft that they use, the Dragon capsule, were all developed for a fraction of the cost of what has been spent in the past on new systems. And this Dragon capsule that just delivered cargo to the space station would be capable of taking humans there, and the heat shield on it is even capable of protecting astronauts on a reentry coming back from the moon. So there's tremendous promise in what they're doing, and I'm tremendously excited about it.
Do you think then private industry could do a better job than governments have thus far?
Well, here's what I think. I think that the space race that we experienced in the 60s and 70s, the Cold War space race, grew NASA at an extraordinarily rapid rate. And what happened was by the time Apollo ended, which again was 40 years ago this December, we had a space agency that had grown very large and had thousands upon thousands of people working for it, not to mention the contractors who were contracted by that. So thousands of people around the country depended on the space program for their livelihood. And I think that that creates an environment in which decisions get made for political reasons as often as they do for exploration reasons. So we had a space shuttle that was supposed to lower the cost of getting into space and didn't do that and ended up being a compromise because of political factors. We had a space station program which took quite a long time and cost an enormous amount of money, despite the fact that nobody at NASA has really been sure of the use of the station. We now have it completed, and it has spectacular research facilities on it, which are being unfortunately underutilized. So, again, I think NASA has been in a pattern for the last 40 years of building things in space to keep the space program going rather than to move us farther out into the solar system. I think now, with the private companies handling the transport of astronauts to and from low Earth orbit, NASA can now focus its resources on going beyond low Earth orbit back to the moon and even beyond that with human beings as well as robots.
If you just joined us, my guest for this first half hour is Andrew Chaikin, the author of the acclaimed A Man on the Moon, several other books about space, space historian. And I wanted to switch, if I could, Andrew, to talking about, rather than humans reaching out from the Earth to explore space, that the possibility of other intelligent life reaching towards us. A while back, National Geographic conducted a poll asking over 1,000 Americans who they felt was better suited to handle an alien invasion as president, President Obama or Mitt Romney. 65% picked President Obama as a leader who they would most want handling this extraterrestrial encounter. Do you spend much of your time thinking about alien invasions?
I spend none of my time worrying about alien invasions. However, I'm very excited by the fact that we have been discovering hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of planets orbiting other stars with missions like the Kepler spacecraft that NASA launched a few years ago. And this is a tremendous new phase in our understanding of the chances for life beyond Earth, because if there are that many planets, some of them have got to have life, and some of that life, I would say, has got to be intelligent. Of course, I'm not the only one that feels that way.
More than 80 million Americans believe that unidentified flying objects exist, UFOs, many of them not afraid, according to this poll, National Geographic, of an aliens dropping in. Here's some audio.
But, I wanted to play. What you're saying is worrisome to me, too.
Let me play this clip from the National Geographic new series, Chasing UFOs, and then get your comment about perceptions.
Okie doke.
In California's San Joaquin Valley,
I saw what appeared to be a fire. This fire started lifting.
A rash of mysterious sightings spark rumors that a secret military base is experimenting with alien technology.
All of a sudden, out of nowhere, a caravan, unmarked trucks came.
Seeking answers, Ryder, Ben, and James travel to Fresno, where the local Skywatchers believe they're the ones being watched.
Wherever I seem to investigate a case on UFOs, white vehicles seem to follow.
Will the harsh conditions force them to drop the case?
Oh, my God!
Or will what they find put not only the investigation, but themselves at risk?
Under the tree, James.
The teaser, the audio from a teaser from National Geographic's new Chasing UFOs series. Of course, Andrew Chaikin, fun to do this, like a Halloween story, like a spooky story, to engage in these kind of thoughts. But what do you think of these perceptions of Americans?
Right. Well, so I think you put your finger on it. It's fun. People love a conspiracy theory. They love to believe that the government is somehow hiding evidence that we've been visited by aliens. It worries me in the sense that this is not science. Science is based on evidence and trying to figure out what that evidence is telling us. We don't have any evidence that stands up to scrutiny that aliens have been here. We only have anecdotes, which are have some ambiguity to them. Nobody's ever found a piece of a spaceship that, you know, defies any explanation other than the fact that it's from somewhere other than Earth. We don't have that evidence. Carl Sagan, the great planetary scientist and popularizer, once said that extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. And that's what he was referring to, the idea that there is life beyond Earth, the idea that we've even been visited by some of that life, is a very exciting idea. But it's an extraordinary claim, and we need evidence that really stands up to the challenge of that. What I worry about in this country is that we're losing critical thinking. Look at all the worry and even trauma that's been going on about supposedly the end of the world this December 21st, supposedly because of something in the Mayan calendar. I don't know what all those people are going to say when the sun rises just as it always has on December 22nd, and we're still here. But, you know, there have even been some suicides among teenagers who have been traumatized by the idea that the world would come to an end. And this points to a desperate need for critical thinking and a desperate need for more science literacy in our culture.
Noted space historian Andrew Chaikin with us. He's coming to Iowa July 6th and July 7th. July 6th in Des Moines, July 7th in Iowa City.
Again in July 8th, I'll be in Davenport at the Putnam Museum.
Forgive me.
No problem. I just want to make sure everybody knows.
No, thank you for jumping in there. July 8th in Davenport. Lastly, in your book, Passion for Mars, you discuss robotic probe discoveries of the Red Planet. When do you expect humans to travel to Mars, if ever?
Well, here's the thing about Mars, and we just lost Ray Bradbury, who to me was the great poet laureate of space exploration. And Ray, I knew him. I talked to him many times. I even commissioned him to write an essay about Mars back in 2000 when I was the editor of a magazine called Space Illustrated. And he said that we are on a million-year journey from the cave to the stars, and that Mars is the way station on that journey. And when you see it in that light, you understand what a momentous task we're on. And everything we learn from the International Space Station, which is delivering wonderful science in some areas, it's just tremendously underutilized, unfortunately. But we're learning about medical problems that we didn't know about before with long-duration spaceflight. We still don't know how to solve the problems of radiation and some of the other medical effects of long-duration spaceflight. We are nowhere near having a spaceship that can function for 2.5 years without spare parts being sent from Earth or without a repair team coming up and fixing it, since that's not going to be possible. And that's what you need to go to Mars. I mean, you need, for example, a life support system that completely recycles water, even from urine and exhaled moisture in your breath, and recycles nutrients in waste products. And, one space scientist recently pointed out to me that if you're on a flight to Mars that lasts 2.5 years and the toilet breaks, everybody dies because that toilet is a key part of the capture and recycling of water and nutrients. And, you know, you simply cannot launch a spaceship to Mars that has all of that supply packed away on it without needing to recycle. So we're a long way from being able to send humans to Mars. Wernher von Braun once predicted in the middle of the 1950s, he said it may be a century or more before we're ready to send humans to Mars. And I think that's about right. I think maybe the middle of this century we might be ready to do it. In the meantime, though, the robotic missions are spectacular, and we have a new Mars mission landing on Mars on August 5th of this year. So I urge everybody to tune in and follow that, because the Curiosity rover, which is the size of an SUV, is going to land on Mars. Hopefully it'll do everything right and it'll get down successfully. But it has the capability to look for organic molecules on Mars, which are the building blocks of life. So if we found that because of the Curiosity mission, that would add tremendous impetus to looking for evidence of past or maybe even present life on Mars.
Is Mars the best chance for either past life or the existence of current life in our solar system outside the Earth?
Well, there are other places that may be just as good and possibly better, and they happen to be the icy satellites of the outer solar system. There are moons orbiting Jupiter and Saturn, which have icy surfaces, but underneath that icy crust, there are oceans of liquid water. And in the case of several of them, you know, there may also be organic materials. By organic, I mean molecules that have carbon in them, like a long chain carbon-based molecules that we think of as the basis for our fuels, you know, hydrocarbons and so forth. One of those moons, Titan, which is going around Saturn, even has lakes of liquid ethane and methane. So it's got basically gasoline lakes on its surface. But under its icy crust, it has an ocean of liquid water. Who knows whether organisms might have evolved in these submerged oceans? And someday, in decades to come, we will have robotic missions that can drill through the ice and search underneath, or at least land on the surface and look at the stuff that's welling up to the surface. So there are plenty of places in the solar system where we can look for evidence of life, and that's one of the great scientific quests of the 21st century.
Andrew Chaikin, just a minute or so left. Supposing we were in a position to travel to Mars, humans were to be able to do that, would you be on the list? Would you sign up?
No, I don't want to go to Mars. What I want to do is do what I interviewed the Apollo guys about, which is not, I don't even need to land on the moon. I just want to fly around the moon and see the far side of the moon with my own eyes and see the Earth from lunar distance.
But listen,
I just want to say one last thing, which is that what I was just talking about with robotic missions searching for life beyond Earth is not going to happen unless we push back against the budget cuts that have been really threatening the planetary program. And so I really urge listeners to let Congress know, if you care about this stuff, to let them know that we want the planetary program to be restored to its healthy level. And you can do that through the Planetary Society website, which is planetary.org. We really do have a kind of crisis going on with the exploration of the solar system, and it can slip through the cracks with everything that's going on in this world. But we need to let them know that it's a very good investment and it's a priority.
Author and space historian Andrew Chaikin is coming to Iowa July 6th in Des Moines, July 7th in Iowa City, July 8th in Davenport. Andrew Chaikin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about space exploration and where we go from here. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll have the president of Grinnell College, Renard Kington. But in the meantime, let's go off into a quick journey into space. This is River to River from Iowa
Ground
Public Radio News.
To Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. 10. Ground control 9. To Major Tom.
So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Dr. Renard Kington, president of Grinnell College, marking 2 years as president of Grinnell College, as a matter of fact. It's part of our summer series of conversations with Iowa University and college presidents. Dr. Kington joining us in our studio in Iowa City. President Kington, thank you for coming back.
My pleasure.
We arranged this interview before we knew the momentous Supreme Court decision would be announced yesterday with its surprise decision. But you are someone ideally suited to comment on it, and I hope you don't mind if I ask you a few questions about that. You are a doctor. You have a medical degree. And before becoming president of Grinnell College in 2010, you were principal deputy director at the National Institutes of Health. Prior to that, a division director at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where you led a large study assessing the health of Americans. So let me ask you, what is your take on yesterday's ruling and the fact that we've become so partisan and divisive in this debate over health care in this country?
Well, I was pleased with the ruling. We as a society for approaching 100 years, since I believe in the early 20s and 30s, the first discussions about some form of universal health care coverage was discussed. And the Affordable Care Act was a significant step to address a major problem, and that millions of Americans didn't have basic health insurance. And we know beyond a doubt that health insurance opens up access to basic health care services and ultimately it leads to better health. So to the extent that this ruling allowed the legislation to go into force and to provide millions of people with health insurance that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford, I think it's a great thing. Everyone, there's a lot of discussion about the peculiar and somewhat surprising alignment of members of the Supreme Court. I'm not an expert in this area, but to the extent that it shows some ability across ideological boundaries to come to a decision that's right for the American people, of course, I was pleased with that.
And of course, in the time that other major steps were taken, Social Security, Medicare, the civil rights era. Do you believe that in the same way this battle, partisan battle, will fade and we'll view it in the same way we do those steps?
I think it's an historic moment. I mean, presidents for decades have tried across both parties, have tried to make progress in providing health insurance coverage to all Americans. So I think this is a historic moment, and so I'm pleased. Of course, we have a long way to go in terms of implementing it and seeing how it actually works in practice.
You've spoken, I know, about health care in the context of race and ethnicity. Can you comment on that?
Well, minorities, the populations that we are now characterizing as minorities, they won't be. The dynamics are changing significantly, but are more likely to go without health insurance, partly because of the types of jobs that they hold. And, for example, the largest ethnic minority are Hispanics, and they are much more likely to be in jobs that are not likely to offer health insurance as a benefit. And historically, we've tied employment to health insurance. Similarly, African Americans are also more likely to not have health insurance. So those communities, and particularly poor communities across racial and ethnic groups, are those most likely to benefit from expansions in health care coverage because they are disproportionately affected by policies that leave many without health insurance.
Part of the Affordable Care Act law allows young people to stay on their parents' health insurance until the age of 26. I'm wondering, as a college president, have you concerned yourself with the implications of the Affordable Care Act being struck down and that not being offered to students of your college?
Well, I think it was an important provision of the law. It had a dramatic, relatively quick impact in terms of the large numbers of young people who had health insurance who otherwise were going to have trouble or couldn't afford health insurance. So I think that's an important a part of the legislation. Also particularly important that it provides coverage when young people are starting out their professional lives and may be more likely to have, particularly in a downturn of the economy, have part-time jobs or jobs where there aren't great benefits. This gives some peace of mind to a lot of younger people and increases the likelihood that they'll have access when they need it. So I think this is a good thing, particularly as a college president, because those are our people,
right?
College students and young people.
If you just joined us, Dr. Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College, is my guest in our studio in Iowa City, part of our summer series of conversations with Iowa University and college presidents. President Kington, thank you for indulging us with your insights on that breaking news from yesterday. Let's move on to get an update from you about goings-on at Grinnell College. Of course, private liberal arts colleges like Grinnell trying to make themselves attractive and affordable in a tough economy. Describe that challenge and how you're meeting it.
Well, it's a challenge for every private college and university in America. And we're all facing our distinctive piece of this large market of higher education. We have over 3,000 colleges and universities in this country, and the diversity of our institutions is part of the strength of that community. But we're all facing unprecedented pressures, because of the increasing costs of college, the greater number of students because of the downturn in the economy whose families can't afford to actually support them to the degree that they could have 10 years ago. The devaluing of real estate, for example, which is how many families finance their higher education for their kids. Greater globalization of higher education, so movement across the world to get higher education of populations. And obviously, we want to both continue to be a first-rate, high-quality liberal arts college, and we want to be sustainable. And we want to do that within the context of our values. So we want to remain a college that's deeply committed to providing access to individuals who have minimal resources or are the first in their families. We want to continue to have a diverse student body. So we're all trying to balance these pressures. Grinnell has been in a fortunate position because we've been able to use our endowment to support a lot of aid. So even though many people look at the prices for colleges like Grinnell, and we're just approaching $50,000 a year per cost, but when you look at the total benefits that we give, about half of our budget every year goes to providing aid to our students, and most of it in the form of grants. So we're working very hard to make sure that we're able to be sustainable, that we have revenues and support, all the different types of support from donations to returns from our endowment to revenue from tuitions from students, so that we can balance these competing goals. But it's a hard task. I mean, look at what happened at University of Virginia, the president there. I mean, that was a perfect case of just the extraordinary pressures that are facing institutions today.
Grinnell College, your college, one of the wealthiest schools in the country, something like a $1.5 billion endowment?
It's less than that now.
Okay.
and it's less than that in the last couple of months.
Okay. But nevertheless, when we have public university officials talking about declining government support, we can understand how costs and tuition rise then. Rising tuition at private schools, well, they don't get the public support. So where is the price rise coming from, the cost of a public education or a private education in higher education there coming from?
All institutions of higher education, for the vast majority of them, their major cost is personnel, people. And the most expensive part of that are faculty, but also increasingly IT support and sophisticated librarian support and lots of infrastructure. So that's two-thirds of our budget, and that's two-thirds of the budget of most institutions. And we're living through a time where those professions are very highly educated, and the returns to investment for those individuals is higher and higher. The salaries of those individuals are going up at a higher rate in every part of the economy, not just in higher education. So that's part of the biggest challenge for us. We have three major sources of revenue, of support for our operating budget: the endowment, investments from the endowment. Second is from tuition, and third is from donations of various types. Some schools also have other streams like research. We don't have a large research component in terms of our revenues. So we have to look at those three sources and try to figure out how to map them against our costs. We want to be able to continue to pay good salaries to our faculty and staff so that we can recruit the best. And that's very important. We're worried that we may be slipping on that front. But we also want to be able to provide access. So that means giving lots of aid. So it's a tough balancing act.
Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College, with us this half hour. President Kington, recently you provided a guest post to a blog in the Washington Post in which you compared college loans to car loans. What points were you trying to make?
Well, I just wanted to make the point that we have to sort of step back and think about borrowing for higher education in the context of a question of what do you get for that borrowing. And my point was I stumbled upon the fact that the average car loan for a new car in America it tracks very nicely with the average college debt. And so and yet we've heard no concern about the average debt for car loans. And the moment you drive your car off of the the parking lot, it's going down in value. And quite the opposite happens with the college education. So I'm not saying that debt is not a problem. It is a problem. And we have students who are graduating with huge amounts of debt and often with a quality of education that's not not at the level that you would expect for the debt. So I want to make the point that we need to think about this trade-off between the debt, but also what we get for that debt, and that means looking at that as an investment. And I'm concerned that we're going to have a simplistic discussion about college debt. And I compare it to our discussions about the costs of healthcare. We've had decades trying to control those costs and have failed largely. And we now have had some more control. We'll see what happens with the new healthcare act. But my point is that maybe we can learn from that experience that we have to sort of really think long and hard about what we're getting, about looking at quality, and looking at comparing what we're paying against what we get. And I believe that for the institutions that provide a really high quality education, some debt is probably appropriate. The question is how much.
How much does a typical Grinnell student graduate with in debt?
Well, we've been very fortunate. Our average debt the last time I looked was $18,000, and that we have approximately $200,000 education. The costs are even higher than that. So our average student graduates with less debt than the average student graduating from either Iowa State or University of Iowa. So we've been fortunate in that we've had loan caps, but every institution that put in those loan caps and things and policies like that, we're all looking at them again because our financial pressures continue to grow and the needs of students continue to grow.
In a recent article, President Kington, you wrote for the Baltimore Sun. We learned that Baltimore is where you spent your high school years.
Yes.
You wrote this: America's 50 wealthiest colleges and universities collectively pour millions into financial aid and recruitment. Yet a March 2011 Chronicle of Higher Education article found that between 2004 and 2008, those measures seem to have barely moved the needle when it comes to educating poor students. Why so little progress?
I think there are lots of reasons. One of the reasons, I believe, is that we have a K through 12 public systems in this country, a sort of a collection of systems where many of the poor students and students of color are trapped, that are not adequately preparing them to excel, to get in and be admitted to institutions like Grinnell, and to excel once they get there. And so while colleges like Grinnell and many other peer institutions have made great strides in increasing diversity, there are entire pockets of K through 12 education where the students don't have a whiff of a chance of ever even applying, let alone getting in and completing a rigorous college education like Grinnell.
And in that article, you point your finger at No Child Left Behind.
Well, I think there are lots of efforts. That was just an indication of the fact that we all as a country recognize this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't gotten the answer quite right. But my point was that while we're fixing the system, and there's no evidence that we really have fixed the system, although there have been some improvements, and that's great. While we're doing that, every year another class graduates ill-prepared for an education, even those who are the most talented of those school systems. So my suggestion was maybe we need for those students to think about having a transition year, similar to redshirting in athletics, where we let someone sort of basically take another year to develop physically so that they can compete on the field in college. Well, if we can do it for physical competition, why can't we do it for intellectual competition?
So what is the solution, though, long-term for K through 12?
I think the long-term solution, you know, it begins early in the development of kids in our communities. So that means, I think, big investments in preschool education, particularly in those disadvantaged communities that are most likely to have their kids start off on a low trajectory. It means creating incentives for performance. I mean, there are lots of sort of tools in the toolkit, and it's nice that we're trying a lot of them. But while we're trying to fix the system, we need to do something about the kids who are still coming through now. I don't want to wait until I'm retired to see us deal with this issue, that there are huge chunks of the community of graduating seniors, mostly from poor neighborhoods, kids of color who don't have a prayer of getting into or succeeding in the most elite schools, and the most selective and elite schools in this country disproportionately prepare the leaders of the next generation.
President,
it matters.
President Kington, last month, I believe, you visited China. Is it Nanjing?
Yes.
A city of about 8 million people in eastern China along the Yangtze River to renew Grinnell College's and Nanjing University's partnership with each other. It's a partnership that goes back many years. It's a program that's growing. Tell us about it.
Yes. Well, Grinnell has an interesting history. During the last century, the early part of the last century, in the 19-teens, Grinnell started a program in China that lasted through up until the 30s, beginning of the World War II. And so we had this interesting base of relationship with institutions and schools. So starting about 25 years ago, we were – when the doors started to open up in China and more collaborative relationships between institutions there and institutions here were started, we formed a relationship with Nanjing University, which is one of their elite schools. It's a large school, and we have a really close relationship. We've had over 40 of their faculty come to Grinnell and teach and spend time. We've had faculty who have in turn gone to Nanjing and taught at their institution. Every year, we send two of our graduates as a part of our Grinnell Core program to teach at the high school that's associated with the college there. We have a scholarship for every year a student is chosen from that city who gets a scholarship to Grinnell. It's been great for us, and no intelligent person in the world now can think that we can ignore China. I mean, what happens in China matters to us, and that's particularly true in higher education. We have a great track record of recruiting and graduating students from China. I think they're about 2-3% of Grinnell's student population. So it's a wonderful university. I think it's an opportunity for our students and our institutions to learn about this increasingly important part of our world.
That we mentioned at the outset that you're marking 2 years at Grinnell College as its president. What do you look back on as your primary accomplishments in these past 2 years?
Well, I mean, what I hope I've done is to start a conversation within our community of faculty and students and alumni who deeply love the institution and to start a conversation about how we can make sure this institution is in the best position possible to continue to provide a first-rate education to the next generation. So we have to look at how we teach, for example. I believe that I'll put our professors against the best professors anywhere in this country. We have first-rate professors who are dedicated to teaching. We get that right. But we have to constantly think about how we can continue to get it better and to respond to a changing world.
Are there areas or is there an area in particular you wish you had made more progress where it was, you say now in hindsight, that the 2 years, that was really slow going. I did not expect it to be that hard.
That's a trick question for a college president. We spent a year of the last year mapping through a framework for a strategic plan. One of our big conclusions that came out of that plan is that we need to stop thinking episodically about strategy. We need to think constantly about how we can get better, how we can make sure that we're relevant in a rapidly changing world, how we can make sure that we're sustainable financially for the long haul.
Okay. To wind up our conversation, we have a couple minutes left. Not a trick question. I hope you'll the next big thing at Grinnell. What's out there on the horizon that you're really looking for in the next few years of your presidency?
Well, we're beginning to establish exploring a setting up a system for us to fund pilots every year that allow faculty primarily, but also staff and students to propose ideas and to get resources to pilot ideas, so that we become a much more learning organization, that we're constantly thinking about new ways to innovate and to do what we do better. And so I'm very excited about that. I think our faculty and staff and students have great ideas, and I want to make sure that we can provide the opportunity for them to act on those ideas and to constantly push the frontier about how we can do better as an institution.
Speaking of faculty, I understand you finished a tour around the world meeting Grinnell College alumni. Anything, a moment, an anecdote, a comment that stood out from an alum that you will remember and you took notice of?
Well, I can remember numerous alum, but particularly one who came up to me at who said that she had come from a remote community, I believe in Nebraska or Montana, and had, through a weird sequence of events, had been recruited to Grinnell. She was a first-rate student, but it was she was not at all destined to go to a place like Grinnell. She thought maybe she was going to end up at a public institution. She ended up finishing Grinnell. She was a Rhodes Scholar. She became a physician and now was in training. And she said, you know, I always thought that I would give back to the college, but I thought I needed to wait until I, you know, had a real job and finished my training. And she said, you know, I'm going to start giving back now because I know that Grinnell changed my life. And I heard stories like that all the time. Hers was truly remarkable. But I heard stories like that over and over.
Dr. Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College, live in our studio here on River to River. Dr. Kington, thank you for making the trip and coming into our studio. It's always a pleasure.
My pleasure. I look forward to the next visit.
All right. We'll look forward to it as well. River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Jeff Schmidt, who is the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.